Accession number 29811, real one.
Well, my name is Albert Shepherd, known in the Royal Artillery as Lance Bombardier, Albert Shepherd. And I've got this good lady here with me, Mrs. Hood. She wants me to interview, she's interviewing me, and I'm a willing participant, very willing. Because I've got so much locked up inside of me, you know, and I want to get it out. People say, why don't you write a book? I say, I can't be bothered writing. You know, when I came back from the prisoner of war camp in Japan, I've never been abroad since. I said, if I got back safe to England, I wouldn't even join the Salvation Army, never mind the British Army. So I got back all right, and thank the Lord I did. Well, I was brought to born at a place called Pity Me, a little tiny village outside of Durham City. And the wonder of being born round there was the cathedral. Gorgeous. A Norman cathedral. As you walk in the entrance in the door, you say, how the dickens did they do it? How did they build a place like this so 1,000 years ago? It's absolutely beautiful. You never forget it. Like Shakespeare said, a thing of beauty is a joy forever, isn't it? Joy forever. Anyhow, my mother, my real mother, died having the 9th baby. My father had been in the First World War. He had 4 years in the trenches. And I was conceived in 1917 and born in 1918. And my dear old mother died about 1924, having the 9th baby. She must have had a rough time bringing those children up during the war years. Shouldn't she? Mustn't she? Anyhow, my dad married again. He married a lady from Fence Houses, not so far away, in County Durham. And she had 3 children. She brought 3 children of her own to the marriage. And then of their union, they had 2 more, that's 13. So we had a football team, a referee, and a reserve, you see? And we all survived, every one of us survived. My father was a coal miner. We moved to Easington Colliery, right on the coast. My father was a miner. Came back from the war and he went straight down the coal mine where he came from. I had brothers John, Billy, Joe, and Laurie was deaf and dumb, and he was the only one that didn't go down the coal mine. But I went down the coal mine, just turned 14, left school at 14, down the mucky pit. And it was the most terrifying ordeal in all my life. Nobody taught you anything to warn you about the ropes, steel ropes, lashing about. I worked at a place 3 miles under the North Sea, and when you cut your finger, the salt water from the ocean above made you sting with the salt in it. Anyhow, I spent 4 years down the coal mine. I was fed up to the teeth. I hated every minute of it. You worked someplace that was so hot and so low, it was like working in HELL hell. Other places, 3 miles under the sea, 7th North it was called, it was about 6 or 7 foot high, it was cooler. But no matter where you were, it was the most dangerous place I've ever been in, even when it counting the war. And when I just turned 18, I decided with my young workmate, Tommy Robinson. Of course, in the army, anybody called Robinson is called Cocky Robinson. Cocky. And he had two brothers. And Jimmy and I got our heads together. We're going to go home off the ship, have our bath in the tin bath in front of the fire. And then we'll have our dinner. And then we're going to go to the recruiting office and join the army. We're fed up with the coal mine. But we didn't know where the recruiting office was. Anyhow, we had 2 brothers. And the eldest one knew the way. So he took us and we finished up at Durham City. And the recruiting sergeant put some simple arithmetic and sums in front of us, you see. And when we got that, all the 3 brothers joined up. So that mother lost 3 sons, 3 wage earners in 1 day. And he gave us half a crown each and sent us down to a certain restaurant. He says, tell her Sergeant so-and-so sent you. We had a pie and chips and peas. And then he put us on the night train to Woolwich. Well, Woolwich is where they train the artillery, you see. It's the first place where they send the artillery for 3 months to square bashing, as they call it, and learning the rudimentaries of gun laying and things like that. In other words, getting you disciplined. No. Because without discipline, you're no good as a soldier, because the lives of your friends depends upon you. If you're not disciplined, you can do things which are really out of character, you know. Anyhow, those 3 months were some of the finest times of my whole life, with plenty good food and fresh air, sleep, not getting up in the middle of the night to go down the pit, fresh, I put weight on. And right towards the last few days before the, called the passing out parade, when the, our battery of about 40 or 50 men passed out in front of the CO, marching up and down and left, right, and slope arms, present arms and all the rest of it, you know. My nose started bleeding. And I couldn't stop it. They couldn't stop it. So they put me in the military hospital, I think it's called St. Herbert Hospital in London. And in the meantime, of course, my battery passed out. I wasn't there. So, anyhow, one day, my two brothers, who were, in the meantime, had left the coal mines and gone to work in London. And they came down the ward and they sat down and said, "Hello, Alfred, how are you?" And I said, "I'm all right." He said, "We've come to buy you out." He said, "My father says you've got to come out of the army," because he had 4 years of it. I said, "I'm not coming out of the army." I said, "I like the army. I made me bed, I'm going to lie in it." He said, "Okay, you can't force you." So I enjoyed the army. It was a life that suited me. Well, they went away and I come out and passed out, and then sent us to down to South Wales, to Manabia. Well, Manabia was a training camp for the Territorials came to Manabia on fortnightly spells, 2 weekly spells, to train in the high finders, gunnery, predictors and things like that. Just the rudiments of the artillery. And while we were there, we fired the first 3.7 gun that was brought up from Woolwich, it was manufactured. And it did sterling work during the Blitz, 3.7, but fired it the first time from Manabia. And I enjoyed life under canvas, thoroughly enjoyed it. Like the trips into Tenby, even when one day a gale blew all the tents down and the tin baths over the cliff, but it's all part of life anyhow. Anyhow, when we finished this spell, about 2 or 3 months we were in Manavia, really, really enjoyable. They sent us home on leave, and then when we came back they said, "We're going to give you a choice of 3 places to go abroad." He said, "You can either go to India, to West Indies, or to Hong Kong." So I said, "Let me see now. I think I'll go to Hong Kong, the farthest away." And after a spell in Glasgow, when Hitler was playing up in Europe, Hitler was shouting, and "I'm going to conquer the world," sort of thing. They put our guns into Maryhill Park in Glasgow, and it rained all the week. And the guns were very heavy, and of course they went down about a foot in the grass. Yeah. We came back from there, embarkation leaving off to Hong Kong on the Dilwara. Well, I've got a photograph of the Dilwara. And going through the Bay of Biscay, it was so rough. The ship was wet up on its side, and it shuddered. It's not going to come back, and it shuddered and came back, and that's the way it was till we got to Gibraltar. And the sailors were all lying on the deck vomiting, the young sailors going to meet to join the ships at Singapore. And an old, remember what an old soldier told me? He said, "If you're ever on a ship and you get, it's very rough," he said, "just keep chewing a sweet or two or biscuits, keep chewing something." And I never had seasickness. I used to walk around the deck and these guys all on the deck vomiting their hearts off. Oh, dear me. We had some fun on that ship. Learned how to play pontoon. Was quite good at that. But the sergeant major's in charge. He all made a bit of money on that. It's an old thing, you know. They call it Housey Housey today. We used to play Housey Housey, but they call it Bingo today. It was Housey Housey. And the sergeant or the sergeant majors, two of them get together and make a good bit of money on them. Well, we arrived at Singapore and we went ashore to swim in the pool. The pool of one of the, I think it was the Norfolk Regiment, not sure. What's in their barracks, there was a big swimming pool, went in there. And then we came back on board and finished up in Hong Kong in 39. And I had the best 3 years of my life out there. It was so wonderful. There wasn't one skyscraper in Hong Kong. Not one. Not one single skyscraper. You could stand anywhere and you see all the hills round about. It was a beautiful Chinese city. A beautiful Chinese city. And the girls, our heads were going up. Because they used to dress in these Chiang Sams, which is a split skirt from the top of the thigh down to the ground. And oh my golly. Being young and red-blooded, you know. And, well, it all added to the joy of Hong Kong. You used to walk down the streets and see them making boxes of sandalwood and all sorts of crafts like we used to do ourselves 300 years ago, you know. I even had a tattoo put on. I didn't want it, but my mate dared me, and I said, you've got to take a dare. So and the old-fashioned way of taking a tattoo was... He had a bunch of needles in his hand, the Chinese man. He just dipped them in the inks and then just stabbed them into your... No electrical equipment then, just a handful of needles in his hand. But, so I've got it on his arm now, a dragon, Chinese dragon. And it was a wonderful life until the Japanese came. You know, the Japanese... I've read quite a lot about what the Japanese did. I think it was 1929, invaded China, invaded Nanking, and they slaughtered tens of thousands there. They used the Chinese as a bit for bane of practice to blood the young Japanese soldiers. And when a Japanese soldier, private soldier, was taken into the army, every day, several times a week, he's given a slapping, you know, good hiding to keep him in, break his spirit, make him obey. And used to break them. And what they did in Nanking, and then they worked their way down the coast all over to Shanghai. And they slaughtered all the way down. By the time they got to Hong Kong, they were practice killers. And Hong Kong, you see, was... Churchill said Hong Kong was a hostage to fortune. Now I thought, what the dickens does that mean? It means it's expendable. It's just to hold up for a little while. Well, we didn't have enough troops there. We never trained properly. We'll train less than the territorials. And but the life was so wonderful before the Japanese came. I started life in Hong Kong on the Gibt, a 9.7. The shell's about 3 foot high, massive things. That was to, in case there was a seaboard invasion. Well, they didn't come by sea, they came by land over Kowloon, across the border. And then I was demoted to, not a demotion, but were transferred to anti-tank guns, 2-pounder. Well, they were useless. Unless the tank was 6 feet away, you couldn't do any damage. It was called a pea shooter. It was a hopeless thing. Hopeless. Anyhow, I had an experience before the Japanese came. I got fed up, and I deserted the army. Now, no one has ever heard this before, but it's too late for them to convict me now. I'm 88, and I've crossed the border into China proper. I put my suit on, my Sunday suit, and I got the train to the border, a place called, a little tiny village on the border called Shumchun, or another name is Lawu. And I crossed the border, and there was a bridge across the little river, and it was guarded, and in the middle there was a Sikh soldier on guard. To stop anyone that wasn't authorised to go over. And I met him, he said, "Where are you going, Sam?" I said, "Oh, I'm a doctor, I'm just going over to the Red Cross." There was a casino over there, and it was made into a Red Cross station, you see. He said, "Oh, all right, Sam." So I just crossed over the bridge and kept walking and walking and walking and walking, up into the hills. I didn't know where I was going, just kept on walking. And I've passed a lot of Chinese people coming down the other way. Most of them are coming this way. It's only me going the other way towards Canton. And I passed one chap, he said, quite perfect English, where are you going? I'm going to join the Chinese army. Very good, he said, very good. He was running away. Well, then the Japanese were at Canton. Because finally I finished up at a place called Wai Chau, about 70 miles over the border, which was evidently the centre of the area. There was a governor there, and he had a large house. We had many, about 30 or 40 different tables for the staff and everything. And I said, where you come from? I said, jump ship, Hong Kong. I didn't jump a ship, I jumped the army. Anyhow, he took me under his wing, this governor, and he had a son the same age as me. And we clicked like that. We used to go about to get his arm around me. They took my suit away and gave me a pair of black pyjamas. Well, the Chinese wear the pyjamas, mostly black. But they're the most comfortable thing you can wear. It's cool. It was red hot up there, but it's cool. And I wouldn't eat Chinese food for the first week or so. I thought, can you eat Chinese food? So I lived on eggs and bread and eggs. And I remember a bit of advice given me by an older soldier many years before. If you ever get into a hot climate, don't eat too many eggs, because it will give you dysentery. And I was sitting on the bog, well, one day the bog was only a shed over the lake, and all you just sat on this, above this hole, and dropped all your doo-doo into the lake. I thought, that's not the hygienic. Anyhow, I noticed there was blood in my stool, and I remember this, what this old soldier told me, and I started eating Chinese food, and it cleared up like that. Well, I found I liked Chinese food. This old governor used to sit at the same table as the governor, and he used to pick tidbits up with his chopsticks and pass them over and put them in my bowl. I really clicked. He must have liked the looks of me. But I enjoyed that. I was up there a month, and I really enjoyed it. They sent off to Chongqing to try and find out where I could join the Chinese army. But in the meanwhile, after a month, I thought to myself, you know, no matter if it's 10 or 20 years' time I put my foot on British soil, they'll nab me. I might as well get it over with. So I said, I'm sorry. I said, the letter hasn't come back from Chongqing. I want to go back, so they took me back to Hong Kong. Well, while I was in Wai Chau, I met half a dozen Indian people, and they formed a team of Red Cross, and they'd come from India to minister to the Chinese soldiers who were fighting around the Canton area, and they were put into barges and brought down the river badly wounded, and some had been lying out in the hot sun all day. You couldn't get to them, and the skin was very badly burned, you know, and used to look after them. These Chinese soldiers, because the Chinese soldiers were very poorly looked after, poorly armed, poorly fed, poorly clothed. But Japanese, you see, they were professional killers. They didn't stand a chance. So they took me back to the border, to Hong Kong. Took two plainclothes policemen and took me back. And we stayed up one night in a Kang, I think they call them a Kang. There's more lice than rice in these kinds, you know. We slept there. And we finished up on the border in Hong Kong. And there were two MPs, red caps, waiting for me. And the red caps said, where the so-and-so did you come from? I said, Wai Chau, 70 miles inland, Wai Chau, quite a largest town. We didn't know there was anybody up there, they said. Anyhow, I finished up in the guard room back at my own barracks, you know. The CO, I was up in front of the CO, cap off, left, right. And he asked me where I'd been. I said, where have you been? I said, I've been to Wai Chau, about 70 miles into China. He said, what were you doing there? The CO, he's a middle-aged man. And I said, I was trying to join the Chinese army. He said, Shepherd, you're a bloody fool. I said, why, sir? He said, you should have stayed with the Chinese army. You'd have been a brigadier general by now. Well, I started smirking on his, he had a smile on his face. He said, 2 weeks in the glasshouse. So I finished up in the glasshouse for 2 weeks. Take your belts away, your shoelaces. Sit in front of the door where I can see what you're doing. When you're free, you're picking coir, which makes the mattresses like them the army sleep on, the biscuits they call them. Coir, coir. And then I knew the Japanese weren't far away. Anyhow, they let us out after a couple of weeks, but in a hurry, I think. Because they realized something was up. But it was several months before the Japs came. And a funny thing happened. I got promoted to a corporal, which is a lance bombardier in the artillery. He must have this guy, must give this fella something to do to keep his mind on his job. So we had the bombardier, you know. And I used to take part with marching the lads around the square and this, that and the other. And then one day we were sent, there was about six of us in a little gun crew, there was only about five or six of us, the pea shooter, the two-pounder, was sent to this place near the town centre, but between us and the town of Victoria, which is where the town is called in Hong Kong, all the buildings are called Victoria, after Queen Victoria. There was a big range of hills or low mountains between us, and we were right beside the sea in a tent with a gun, and there was a private house there. We'd been here months before, and the couple that lived in this house had gone to Australia, advised to get out before the Japs came. And we could hear the guns going off over the hills, and could see the flashes of fire, the guns, and the machine guns. And I thought, well, I hope we don't get over there, because I'm quite happy here, by the sea. And the hills sort of protected us. And then we got an order to go up to Shaki One. Well, Shaki One is on the seafront in Hong Kong Harbour. There's buildings all the way along. You pass Wan Chai, the red light district, where the feed club is. You go right way along to Shaki One, which is right near the narrow straits where Devil's Peak is, and the Wan Chai Gap, I think it's called. And that's the end of the dockyards. Dockyards, and there's these flats, some Chinese flats, about four or five high. And we climbed and kept climbing up. We got to the top of the hill. We turned right to go down. Once we got to the top of the hill, we looked down into hell. The place was all on fire. Burning. Everything was burning. And in the army, you're told, always obey the last order. Right or wrong. This turned out to be very wrong. We went down with this old truck pulling the gun behind it. We disconnected the truck and drifted away. Put the gun. And we found out that the main gates into the dockyard, where we were supposed to be meeting the Japs head on and do a landing, was locked, couldn't get in. All there was a wicket gate about 3'6" wide, and we couldn't get the gun through there, so that gun was useless. And as we were going through this wicket gate, the Indian troops, the Sikhs, I admire the Sikhs were coming out. And this Sikh says to me, "Where you going, Saab?" I said, "We've had last order to go into the dockyard. The Japanese are going a landing there." He said, "We've had last orders to come out. They're going to shell it." And you know, they came out and we went in like fools, because the last order, it's a thing you must obey. We hadn't been in 10 minutes before we heard this gun go off in the hills, several miles up in the hills. And it came over, one after the other. And they shelled all around the dockyard, and we were trying to find somewhere to hide, to dig a hole in the concrete, which was impossible, and we're snuggling up against the side of this building. And the shells were landing, and I knew the sergeant major in charge of the gun that was firing them. I'd met him in Stanley Village a few days before. And he was my sergeant major in Litchfield, in the barracks. He said, "Well, Shepherd, it's nice to see you." He said, "Where are you going?" I told him. He said, "Where I'm going," he said, "I won't get out of it alive." He didn't, I don't think. He told me he was going to have this gun. This gun was firing. Well, in the end, we said, "If we stop here, we're going to get blown up to smithereens." So we made our way to this small wicket gate. And when we got out there, there was a hand grenade came flying over it. It dropped where that vase was. And we didn't get hurt. I said, hey, we're British. And this Indian voice gave, I'm sorry, sir. You thought we're Japanese? Anyhow, we got out in the roadway, and the roadway would be a bit wider than this room. And the whole width of the road, there was a shell hole about 6 feet deep or more, covered the whole width of the road, and it was about 30 foot from where we was trying to dig a hole in the concrete. I'm glad we came out, because the next one might have been soon. We had the target fairly well. Anyhow, we got outside, we couldn't take the gun, so we left the gun, but it was useless. Anyhow, there was little 2 pounds, you know. You couldn't do anything with 2 pounds there. 25 pounds we had in the desert was a different thing. The blood, knock any chunk out. But a 2 pound a piece shoot was no good. Anyhow, we're walking back, and the sergeant says, fix bayonets! So we fixed bayonets, you know, in case we met the Japs on the way. I thought we'd train, we didn't, because they'd kill us, you know, they were trained killers. And they were quicker with a bayonet than we were. More practice. Ours had been sticking them into bags of straw, but they were sticking them into human bodies and